The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Brains, a podcast exploring the inner workings of our brains and how film and television portray them. Hosted by me, writer-director Heather Taylor.
And by me, film and television editor Sarah Taylor. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast, and from where you are listening, are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place of diverse Indigenous peoples. And we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us, and we encourage you to do the same.
We had the pleasure of interviewing fellow Respectability alum Michael J. Doherty about spina bifida and hydrocephalus, and discussed disability representation in Guillermo del Toro films such as The Devil's Backbone and The Shape of Water. Michael is a film person, screenwriter, essayist, occasional actor, and advocate living and working in Hollywood. He's also the co-founder of the Real Abilities Film Festival Los Angeles, entering its sixth year, which presents films and discussions by and about the disability community.
A quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice, as it is for informational purposes only. Because everybody's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions. And now, Michael.
Hello, Michael, and welcome to Brains.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing good.
We're doing good.
Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you.
Yes, I'm so glad to have you. Now, to start off, we're going to ask the largest question in the world. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I was born with a condition called spina bifida and another condition called hydrocephalus. I'm from New York originally, and fell in love with the movies when I was about three, which is an actual memory, and went to NYU Film School, which was an experience I hated.
Oh, no.
It was awful.
I've heard questionable things, yes.
Yeah, I don't recommend film school for anybody because there are, you know, film students there. biggest problem with it.
Oh, I love it.
But I recovered from that. And then about 10 years later, well, 8 years later, I went to the National University of Ireland in Galway and got a master's in screenwriting.
Nice.
I needed an adventure because I'd been very sick on and off through my 20s and was finally better. And then I was like, I need to do something. And I thought, why not go to Ireland? Because that's where all my people are from. And my parents were encouraging the screenwriting masters because you could ultimately teach with that. And because they would always say things like, you know, if you want to win the Oscar, you know, you should be, that's fine, but do something in the meantime. But joke's on them because I don't care about that. So, but yeah, so I never actually ended up teaching. But what it did do is it landed me in LA because I was one of the top students in my class. And they gave me a scholarship to take a course at UCLA the summer after I graduated. And there I found out about the Writers Guild and what was at the time called Writers with Disabilities, a committee in the diversity department, and got heavily involved with them for the better part of 12 years. And they accepted my master's thesis screenplay, which was a thrill because it was crazy. And I just started working sort of on the ground in movies. I call myself a film person because it's not just about making them or, you know, it's writing, it's directing, it's producing, it's editing. It's every aspect of it I'm completely obsessed with, but it's also the history of it and it's advocating for it. Like, for example, I'm the co-founder of the Real Abilities Film Festival here in LA. I'm no longer associated with it, but I helped start it. And that's a disability-centric film festival in which over 3 days, movies about and by those with disabilities get shown. And it's been a pretty successful little venture. So, and now we're in the middle of a writer strike and I don't know what to do with myself.
Oh, this is why you're here. Yeah. You can talk to us.
Thank you for, now you have some time. Thank you so much.
Love the idea of film person. I'm going to start using that. That's really great.
I'm going to go back to the very first thing you said, that you have a memory of loving film and television from the age of three.
Yes.
What was that memory of?
So my earliest childhood memory was when my mother took me to see E.T. when I was three. And the reason that they say you can remember back that far is if pain were involved. And in my case, I was recovering from brain surgery. And so my head was sutured and I had these uncomfortable bandages and it was just painful and itchy. And so I guess my mom wanted to take me to give me a break, but it also give herself a break. And I don't really remember much except the one thing I do know is that when the ship comes down in the beginning, when the E.T. gets lost, and all those brilliant lights are shining through all those Northern California evergreens, I went from feeling pain to not feeling pain in an instant. And my mother later confirmed that I was being very squirmy that day. And about partway through the movie, she looked over and saw me just sitting there very, very quietly, sort of engrossed in the whole thing. And what I sort of took from that is that, for my life at least, there's this connection between the experience of art, particularly movies in my case, and the relief of pain. Mm. And that's something that I've sort of carried both sort of artistically and politically throughout my entire life. And I mean, wearing your Horror Heels T-shirt today. And part of that ethos for me is that to experience terrible things on screen is actually therapeutic and it's healthy because it allows us to sort of deal with it and reconcile it in one form or way, like psychologically in our own lives. So that's was very important to me. But I really did carry that from a child all the way until I started to really to develop my own voice as a film person. But those who knew my work when I first started back around the film school days would lovingly accuse me of trying to rewrite E.T. in my own image. I mean, that's how much of an effect it had, is that the narrative of magic coming into someone's life that is sad and supposedly broken and dealing with that in some way has been like, that's been the narrative.
Amazing. You know, just for some of the people who are listening, can you talk about what is spina bifida and how is hydrocephalus related to it?
Sure. So spina bifida is the second most widely recurring neurological disorder, at least in the United States. I believe CP, cerebral palsy, is the first. Spina bifida is the second. And what happens is that in utero, the spinal cord doesn't form and close properly. There's what's called a neural tube around that's supposed to protect those nerves. And because of a lack of folic acid on the part of my mom when she was pregnant with me, led to this not forming properly. And what happens is that the biggest thing is paralysis of some form happens as a result of this. Now, there are three different types of spina bifida. There's myelomeningocele, there's meningocele, and there's occulta. Myelo is the most severe, which is what I have. I am only paralyzed from the knees down, though, because it was on, I think, the lumbar, L2 lumbar. So really far enough down on the spine where it only affected a part of it. Whereas if you had it closer to your neck, you get like there, we talked about in prep for this about the actor who's in that movie, Shallow Hal, the Farrelly Brothers movie, who gentleman, his name's Reen, and he walks on his knuckles. He has a form where it was higher up. So it stooped him over in a way. And I don't have that, but I do have the most severe kind. And what happens with an infant or baby that's born with spina bifida is you get what's called a Chiari malformation, where the brain ends up being larger than the skull. And so it's trying to push its way out And hydrocephalus is normally part of that, where you have these ventricles in the brain, which are filled with cerebral fluid. And in an average person, that drains out to the rest of the body, and the brain remains the size that it's meant to be. But with hydrocephalus, it swells. I think the sort of crude term is they call like water on the brain. And so pressure starts to build up. And how that affected me certainly was I suffered what was called optical nerve atrophy, where some of my optical nerves were actually crushed, which screwed up my vision to one degree or another, which was sort of fun. Then I got the idea in my head, oh, I'm going to go make movies now. But, you know, I love a challenge. Don't back down easily from them. So that was pretty much how I ended up. And then I had it, and they thought that maybe they could reverse it with physical therapy, because it wasn't really, I mean, it was well known. I mean, the first case was like back in like the 1400s, I think. But it was still being decided about whether to let babies like I was live. And back in the 70s, 80s, that's when the idea of bioethics really came into play about what to do with someone who has a severe disability. And my parents were very stalwart in that. Said, no, let them go. And they tried to reverse it through physical therapy. It didn't work. And if I can tell you another memory that sort of spells a lot of this out, is that when I was doing that physical therapy, I was probably like a year and a half, 2 years old, trying to walk. And my mother said that I was making my way along the hallway in a rehab center in New York, and I fell and started crying. And the therapist went to pick me up, and my mother held her back and said, no, Mickey, come on, get up. It's okay. You're going to be fine. And a few seconds later, I calmed down, got back on my feet, and started back down the hallway again. And that's been sort of their attitude. And I honestly think that the reason I'm here right now talking to you is because of that, because they pushed independence over, you know, just sitting in your tears. And
that made me tear.
That
up
makes
a little.
Me cry. Yeah. I'll sit in my tears.
That's beautiful.
Your parents are wonderful. Well, let's talk about movies. Us film people. You recommend The Devil's Backbone as something that has a representation of spina bifida. How do you think this representation has impacted the way people think of spina bifida?
This was difficult, but I still think that it's like kind of worth talking about, is that I'm not actually sure that there has been a full-fledged, full-blooded, dynamic, complex view of this condition and characters dealing with it. I mean, you have something like Shallow Hal, which is inclusive, and it shows that a person can be in the world and having a good time and all that. And I love the Farrellys for being that forward thinking. I mean, they really are some of the great disability advocates in this town. But then I thought about the Devil's Backbone, because it actually does directly reference it. And what was interesting to me about that is that the reference was in a movie that wasn't maudlin, wasn't cute, and had a very serious point to make. And so while I won't defend it on the grounds of it being a proper representation, because like I said, there hasn't really been one. What was so powerful to me was, you know, you have the scene where the doctor is talking to the main kid and saying that, you know, this was a place where they used to send these patients, these little kids with spina bifida, and we're in this orphanage, like far out in the desert. And I remember thinking, oh, so I wasn't isolated as a child, because my parents made the effort to do that, but they had to make that effort, because the sort of social standard, particularly throughout the early 20th century in any part of the world, was if you were born different, you need to be hidden away. And the thing that I have both appreciated and sort of and also questioned about Guillermo del Toro and his work is that he really does want to hold the other up. But that has gotten complicated for me over the years, But I still think with this movie, with Devil's Backbone, that he is pointing out something that is terribly true. As recent as 2014, when I went to Russia to write about the Paralympics in Sochi, which was the first time that they had happened there. And I ended up talking to a number of people, including doctors, and they told me that they've had so much disability denial in that country that if a person had been born at the time I was born, which is 1979, I would have been taken from my birth mother and either sent to a like-minded orphanage or institution, like in Siberia, or sent to be adopted in another foreign country. So this is not a medieval practice. This is something that we're still sort of contending with today, and it requires that people use their voices to sort of speak up. And I always think that art is the best way to do that, because, like I said, I went to go see that movie because I like horror movies and I like ghosts and you know, monsters and things like that. And I like Guillermo del Toro. And then I was really floored by, like, they actually said the word spina bifida. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, I really, it was interesting too, because it was showing some of the like superstitions around disability as well. This idea that they're literally creating what they called limbo water because people thought it would heal them to have, it was basically, I'll say, like babies with spina bifida in jars. And it was interesting because there was this idea of like, he's like, I'm a man of science, but Spain is full of superstition. It was a very fearful time and that, you know, otherness is coming into play. But he's like, there's a scientific reason for this, but I'm going to make money off of it to fulfill the superstition of others. So it was just such an interesting conversation, even in it when they did talk about it, because it's not, the whole film is named The Devil's Backbone, which is a name given to spina bifida, was a devil's backbone. And so the whole film is about spina bifida, but told in different, probably different ways, and not necessarily showing it, like as you were, you know, saying before, that there's something that he was talking about of this like limbo-ness and this otherness, like you were saying, that a lot of his films talk about.
Well, just the idea of the ghost. I mean, it's the incomplete story, like the incomplete spine. And I have sort of questions when anybody sort of uses disability as a kind of metaphor or a symbol and not as like a real experience.
Yes.
But I think he's actually like, that was correct. Like that struck me as like, oh, okay, that made sense mm-hmm. to me.
And I think that there is maybe off the back of that, obviously we haven't seen a lot of, when we talked, you said there's two things. There's two things. And one is like, essentially not a living, breathing person that can represent spina bifida in Del Toro's film. And then you have the one character in Shallow Hal. But, you know, what are some common stigmas that you think that you know of spina bifida? And like, how would you like to see it represented in TV and film or in media?
Well, I think the problem is that we're all seen as sad bastards that can't do anything.
Mm.
I mean, the sad bastard thing, that follows every single person with a disability around. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a completely miserable experience. And look, I'm having brain surgery next week, so it's not as though I'm like, hooray for that. But we do sort of overcome these things and get through it as people. It's just what we do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a problem. I think what's interesting about Del Toro is that he, and I really believe this about him, is that he genuinely thinks that what would be deemed monstrous by the mainstream is genuinely beautiful mm-hmm. to him.
Mm-hmm.
Where I part company with him is he hasn't figured out a way to bring that beauty into the rest of the world. It tends to stay in its own world,
mm-hmm.
apart from everybody else.
Yeah.
Like an orphanage, or like the ending of Shape of Water is literally making that statement. I think that that's dangerous. I think he needs to sort of grow and find a way to reconcile the monster with everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this idea of like the way he looks at me, he doesn't know what I lack or how I'm incomplete. And just those words in themselves are indicating that because you are disabled that you are incomplete or that you are lacking, which are both inaccurate. Yeah.
Yes. And the thing is, I can understand that point of view because I'm sure, I mean, like as an 11 or 12 year old, where I went to surgeries every single year and then was bullied in between. So I didn't have a fantastic childhood. There was a lot of reasons for me to hate having spina bifida. But first of all, you grow and you learn and you come to grips with things and you find what's good about yourself and the world and then you get on with it. But it's a problem for me when art in particular, which is something that we implicitly learn from as a planet about how to behave without really being given, you know, a lesson, because I would not want that at all.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that experience yourself, mm-hmm. saying that this character that you wrote is incomplete is then very dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
Totally.
I read this really amazing article by Anna Wall on cripplemedia.com. And she said, it's not about what you can't do, but how non-disabled people react to inability that makes them feel like an outsider. So it's more believable for a woman with disability to fall in love with a fish man than to fall in love with an able-bodied man. It's like we need society to be accepting of our disabilities that so those disabilities can melt away and become as unimportant to the outside world as it is to us.
Exactly. And ever since that movie won Best Picture, which on the one hand, from an artistic standpoint, I'm glad that a movie about a woman fucking a fish won a mainstream award. Like, yes, that's cool to me.
Yeah.
But I think if he had done one more rewrite in which he considered that making the Sally Hawkins character just a person who could talk, who then falls in love with the fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was the end of the story. Then he would have nailed it. Then it would have been probably my favorite movie of all time. But he still had this thing where we have to make sure that they're together, but apart. And I was like, you know, anyone going into that movie with a disability would understand that we're supposed to be the fish. Like that's very clear. It doesn't need to be underlined, but he doubled down on it. Yeah. And the whole enterprise for me kind of fell apart as a result.
Yeah. I know someone who had epilepsy because of scarlet fever. And so was sent to a school, like a separate school. So everyone was separate. This idea of separateness so that you are being isolated. No one is meeting anyone with disabilities. And then therefore you're creating this like world where you're expecting no intersection. But we all live in the world and we all should be intersecting and living together. And there shouldn't be that separation, isolation. And then, like you're saying, we're seeing in films that only you can find love and only be together if you're isolated.
And with someone who's just like you, as opposed to just somebody.
I want to ask you, you said that there's this one quote that you really believe in. I'm going to read the quote. If we're all going over the edge, and we are, shouldn't we laugh on the way down? How does this quote relate to your day-to-day life?
Well, I'm the one who said it, so I have to take responsibility.
Oh, it is your quote.
That's what I said.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, that's even better. Okay, why did you say that? I love it. That's great.
Well, I was just on a panel at Respectability a few days ago, talking about writing, and the whole notion of hope came up with my co-panelist. And I immediately sort of swooped in and was like, no, kind of screw hope, blah, blah, blah. And my reason for saying that, and this is tied to the quote, is that I think it's all going to end badly. And we have intermittent moments of joy and light along our lives, but a whole hell of a lot of difficulty. And I don't necessarily see the point in wishing that something in the future is going to make things better. We have to deal with right now. And it also comes from the fact that Samuel Beckett is my favorite writer of all time, and Waiting for Godot is my favorite piece of writing. It's the thing that means the most to me in the world. And the whole thing about that play is about these two guys that are facing the everyday drudgery of the march toward oblivion, but they survive it because they have one another. I think that's sort of the untapped sort of message of that piece. And so, yeah, I do think that we're going over a cliff. It's inevitable. There's value in screaming against the silence. There's value in laughing it up. There's value in taking as much meaning out of a meaningless world as you can, just to thumb your nose at that universe and say, oh, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
And particularly for people with disabilities who have to sort of like carry their pain around and their experience around on their bodies, which other people are automatically going to judge as terrible, you might as well find the way to repurpose that experience to make it fuller and more dynamic. I don't mean to like deny that you're in pain, quite the opposite. I'm saying that we have to find a way to mix the sweet and the sour, as Billy Wilder would say. That's where that comes from.
I love it. I think Sarah is probably one of the most positive people, but it's not positivity to erase things. It's like, it's about finding joy where you can find joy, or finding that idea of like, you know, let's carry on together in the best way we can. And that's why I really like that quote, because I pulled it out and I was like, yeah, I want to talk about that. Because I think sometimes you can get caught up in the pain of the world, not even your own pain, but also the pain elsewhere. Someone asked me, are you an activist? And I couldn't think of the word. I said, I just want people to be curious. I just want to have people understand everyone's experience a little bit better, maybe create empathy, but mostly just like, just understand that we're all in this together in some capacity. Exactly. We're in this together.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So in thinking differently and, you know, showing work that we may not get to see, you did mention earlier that you co-founded Real Abilities Film Festival in Los Angeles. In your opinion, what has its impact been?
Well, for one thing, it proved that the community is much larger than certainly the media will portray.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in at least in LA, and I know every single one of them, but that are hungry to have these types of stories be told and are not going to, you know, go gently into that good night, you know, and not having had it accomplished. And my whole thing about starting it apart from, I just like a challenge because my mom had sent me an NPR interview with one of the main people who started the whole organization back in New York. And it came up like, why aren't you doing this in Hollywood, which is, you know, it's the movie capital of the world. And he said, well, it had something to do with real estate. And I naively was like, well, you know, there's about 160 film festivals around the year. Mm-hmm. At any given moment in LA, this should not be that difficult. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly difficult because access was actually the biggest thing. It was like, where can we? Because I was like, you know, we're showing this in a movie theater. We're not going to some library and setting up folding chairs. Like, we're going. I'm taking this to a movie theater. That's where the temple is. That's where we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was impossible to find a place in a decent part of town where everybody could get to that had, you know, seats that we could remove and for the wheelchairs and things like that. And it was a nightmare trying to figure it out. And it went on for like 3 years trying to figure it out. And then we finally figured, well, no, we're just going to sort of ask them to do it and make sure that it gets done. And we had the backing of the city, the Department of Disability here in LA. And that's how we're able to get it done. And it's a 3-day festival, so it's relatively small, but it was manageable. So we had people that were coming for the entire weekend and watching everything. And I ran the majority of the Q&As more by necessity than anything else. But for example, like we when COVID hit, we had to regroup. And so we did a virtual version of it where you could watch the movies through a website and then come on to Zoom and have the discussions that way. And it was the greatest honor of my life that in 2020, we did a 30th anniversary screening of Edward Scissorhands, which is another one of my favorites and a formative experience. And I got to interview Caroline Thompson, who wrote it.
What?
And you can get that interview on YouTube if you so desire. But that was really why I wanted to do it, sort of like from like a personal sort of like movie. Like, I want to do an anniversary screening of Edward Scissorhands, and I want to talk to this woman and get to the bottom of it. And I got to, so.
That's absolutely amazing. If you could talk to Del Toro tomorrow, because he's the man I think we need to talk to. How would you like him to represent disability on screen in a different way?
First of all, he needs to hire a writer, because he tends to co-write a lot of these movies. And if he wants to explore that, that's fine. I'm all for that. But he should get somebody that actually has the experience, because I think it'll only make the movies better. And it'll make this love of monsters and discomfort that much more profound if he gets more people around him that really on a granular level understand what that feels like. And I'm sure he has his own version of that, but I would say that. I would also say that if we have this sort of technology to manipulate faces, he should go back. He should have Sally Hawkins reloop all the lines that she signed and change her mouth to move, because you can do that, and have her speak. And then I'll fall back in love.
But, yeah. Redo.
But that's what I would encourage for any creator, is that I don't believe in the idea that I have spina bifida, so I'm the only person that can make the spina bifida movie. I think that's kind of silly and it's limiting. But I do think collaboration is of the utmost importance. And they say, you know, nothing about us without us. I do believe that.
Me too.
But I don't want to start a fight with the able-bodied world. Able-bodied, by the way, is a phrase I can hate.
I hate that too.
It creates this binary where I'm suddenly broken and different from everybody. I just can't. Ugh.
I also don't like neurodivergent as a term. Yeah. That's thrown in, like, I'm thrown in that bucket, but also like, what am I then? Yeah. We've somehow, this is a phrasing that's happened, but I don't think that's the right phrasing.
And it rings like somebody else made that decision and not
the
people that they're actually talking about.
How do you think we should change language around that? I wonder.
Well, this is an interesting thing, because I don't even like disability or disabled or anything like that necessarily. And what I always say to people is, I was born with spina bifida and hydrocephalus. Those are two inescapable scientific facts. Mm-hmm. And I will take all the time out of my spina bifida day in order to talk to you about this particular condition. I will answer any question you have.
Yeah.
All the rest, I think, is just rumor and conjecture about what I am and am not capable of doing. And it varies from person to person. And those people should be able to define who they are. Like, the whole idea of there being like a disability movement, a disability pride, really scares me, because it's people trying to group themselves together, and they're doing it to be powerful. But it's like, no, I want to just be who I'm going to be, and I would like to speak to you because you are neurodivergent. I want to understand that experience, and you're wearing glasses, and I would like to know about your eyesight, and so that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that would be a healthier, more meaningful discussion.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I have someone I'm close to in my life who doesn't talk about the disability in their family, doesn't talk about disability openly. I have, and especially since attending Respectability, I'll say, and since like having to step forward, and I feel like disability becomes a bad word for people, or a word that makes you seem, oh, well, you're not capable then. I've been told that to my face. Oh, then you can't be capable. And I want to demonstrate the variety of who we are as, I guess, a group of people, but also that it's not a group. When you meet someone, that's it. And I feel like by opening up and being forward about that, the idea of like, there are a lot of us and we just don't feel safe necessarily telling you if we have invisible disabilities, like having something where I've told someone I have a neurodevelopmental disorder and that's ADHD, and being told, oh, don't tell people that, you're neurodivergent, it's a superpower. And I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah, no, stop saying those. Stop. I'm like, exactly. I was born with a different brain. It is totally, that's the way that I see the world. It's the way that exists in the world. And the world was not made for me. And so therefore, if we can create better environments with universal access, then we're going to create a world that is available for everyone. Why not tell people, like, stop being biased and stop being ableist? And how about you just create a better world for all of us and show us on screen and put us in the rooms and put us on the crews?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Preach.
I have lots of thoughts.
I can tell.
Well, I'm going to ask, what do you want people to take away when they're thinking about spina bifida after listening to this?
That I'm super hot.
I can corroborate that statement.
Let me quickly back away from that.
Don't back away.
What was the question? What do I want people to take away from spina bifida? Everybody's got a thing.
Yes.
Everybody's got a thing. And I think all of those things are worth understanding and reconciling to one degree or another. And we get nowhere by not talking about it. We get nowhere by demanding that people look at it in a certain way when it simply isn't true. Like you were saying about how you feel about neurodivergence. I'm having brain surgery next week. There's likely going to take a hacksaw to my skull, and I'm not going to be able to get out of bed. I want the room in order to complain about that. That this kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also want to make abundantly clear that it is not the entire experience. And human beings are resilient. It's what we're famous for. And people with disabilities are awesome at adapting. If you want to call that a superpower, that I'll allow. Because we have figured out a way to put up with other people's garbage for so long when it's just not, it's not acceptable at this point. There's no reason why we don't have ramps to everywhere, because, you know, everyone can use those.
Yeah.
Yes.
Everyone.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
There's no excuse. And so I would say it's about listening and really sitting down and looking one another in the eye and talking about this. And just like, you know, the example always comes up about like the little kids that would stare at me, which thank God for the pandemic and I never had to leave the house, so I don't have to deal with that. But typically that's what happens. I leave the house and people are staring, or they want to touch me, or they want to say things. I mean, talk about a Me Too situation. The disability community has been Me Too'd like every single day since we were children in many ways, because of the attitudes that people have. But you have this thing with children where if they're curious about something, they'll ask their question and then they get over it because they're children. It's not a thing anymore. But the more that the parents steal them away and say, don't look at that, or don't talk to him, or, you know, you're being rude or whatever, that is incredibly damaging. And it makes my experience, because I remain self-conscious, harder to deal with. So it's not the spina bifida, it's the social stigma around it that's actually the thing that's getting to me. And I practiced transcendental meditation and got to a certain point where self-consciousness kind of left me, and I was able to leave the house. And I was actually shocked when I realized that was happening, because I was so used to the idea of like, okay, now you got to go put the face on because your audience is awaiting you. And I'm glad that I reconciled that in myself. And I am living a much happier, more peaceful life at this point. But everybody else needs to sort of get on board.
I have a colleague who is a wheelchair user. And I remember him once saying that when, you know, kids are staring and parents are like, shh, he's like, just get your kid to ask the question. So I remembered that. And then I could see him from afar at a festival we were at. And my daughter was with me. And she's like, oh, what happened to that guy? I was like, well, let's go talk to him. She asked her questions and that was it. And now that's her friend Daniel. So I think it's very simple. People who don't have the same experiences, you just like let your shit go out of the way for a second and just also be curious. It's just, it makes me angry.
Yeah. Or I was at an event and there was a gentleman there with CP and he was a wheelchair user, and he is fucking hilarious and raunchy, and we had like the best conversation, but I could see people not coming over. I noticed that. I'm like, just come over and have a conversation. We had like the best time. I'm like, this was the best day that I had. It was very apparent the separation in the room for no particular reason. And I felt like there was people being unsure of like what to say. And I think because there is that stigma and there's this lack of sometimes integrated community, that people feel unable to have conversation because they're like, well, what if I don't know what to say? What if I don't say the right things? Instead of just saying, hey, I'm Heather. Nice to meet you. That's it. That's what you say. That's it. And then you go from there.
Well, it's like your fellow countryman Wayne Gretzky would say, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you do not take.
Yes.
Yes. Thank not you only, for incorporating.
Not only our countryman, but an Oiler, a former Oiler.
Our city.
If you did not know that, we are both from Edmonton, Alberta.
That's like way up, isn't it? That's like Neil Young country, isn't it?
Well, we are the northernmost capital city that's a province. Because we have territories more north.
So but, it's very cold all the time.
No, it's very hot right now. But yes, it can be cold in the winter.
Wow. I did not think that the conversation about spina bifida would move to meteorology, but here we are. Yeah.
The places we go.
There's probably lots we haven't talked about, but is there anything, one last thing that you'd like to say that you may not have talked about that you would like to talk about that you will be upset if you later leave this recording and think, why didn't I say that?
There's always going to, I mean, I'm Irish, like regret is like a thing I do. But
our family's Roman Catholic.
I feel like we're really
that's Irish Catholic. Michael. Yeah, it's kind of par for the course. You know, they hand you your regret card when you're born. We didn't really talk about like actual like making movies and things like that. And what I would say is create universal design for sets. It's a given. You're hauling around heavy equipment, there should be ramps and pathways set out and bathrooms that everybody can use. This is not rocket science. It's not even elementary school science. It's just so easy to implement. But also I want to see the stories like The Devil's Backbone, but by a person with a disability that really wants to confront how he or she could have been the person in that jar.
Mm.
And what the ghost of that fetus might be thinking. Because, you know, for every shape of water, and I'm going to fire a shot and forgive me for this, but you get a coda, which I think is a noble attempt, but there's a part of me that thinks, well, they're still going for the touchy-feely thing. And I think there's a bit too much of that around disability. So that's why I love horror movies so much. And I'm sort of obsessed with how disability links all the way back to the Thomas Edison version of Frankenstein, which is one of the first silent films. I mean, disability and horror have always been there together. And I'd like to know why. What's the fascination there, and can we make meaning out of that? And which I think we can, and I do. I mean, all of my writing has people with disabilities just covered in gore, because that's just my bread and butter. And actually, we had a scene presentation a while back, and the scene I presented was from my Blacklist disability list script, which involves homicidal special needs kids, and. It's a scene where these two are basically playing with a severed head. And she came up to me, this person came up to me afterwards, and she's like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you representing people in this way? It's gross. And my first response was, well, hey, you show me a better world and I will go point the lens or the mirror that way. I'm happy to do it. But until such time, I'm not abiding by that. But it's also because, like I said, love horror movies. I've been obsessed with that kind of stuff since I was a little kid. And just stepping aside from that I was the guy who wrote it, I was like, holy cow, I'm seeing a scene where kid with spina bifida and an amputee are playing with a severed head and they're being really mean and nasty. And I'm like, yeah, I want to see stuff like that. I want to see how we can include things in ways that are genuinely inclusive, but also have the capacity to make people uncomfortable to where we have to ask questions. Because that was the whole thing. It's like, where did these kids get to the point where they had to take off a person's head? That was the larger question out of all the sort of carnage that I was building up. too. So,
what is the name of your script?
It's called No One Is Looking, and it's about a kid in a wheelchair who's about to graduate college and go to film school, hopefully, and he kills a bully in a blackout, drunken rage, and gets away with it because no one believes that a kid in a wheelchair would be capable of that. And he gets tasked with finding, and this is actually a second severed head, the severed head of I have a thing with heads, and removing them. He gets tasked with finding that bully's severed head as like the last piece of evidence that might get him caught. And then to throw in the wrench, one of his childhood friends shows up and says, hey, if we can get away with this, this means we can kill anybody we want. And chaos
the adventure
ensues.
Begins. Well, that movie needs to be
and
made.
And it's a musical.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it's not. No.
I'm leaving that in. I'm going to make everybody think it's a musical as well. Yeah. Oh, tossing around the head. I don't know.
Okay, Sarah's going to be now the composer of the musical? Don't you worry. We got you, Michael.
It's happening.
We got you.
The movie's being made.
Nice. Where can people find you?
I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram as Mike on Sen, as opposed to mise en scène. And my the blacklist, I'm not sure what the status is with the Writers Guild, but there was a time at which you could just go on and then look up that script or my name, and anybody could look at it if they wanted to. So
thank you again for coming and joining us on Brains. And we really appreciate all your time and your stories.
Thank you.
Thank you. And sweet, sweet Return of the Living Dead reference, by the way. With the name of your podcast.
Yes.
Yes. We.
Yes. So. Thank you. And thank you. I'm glad you noticed that, because that is exactly what we were intending.
Sometimes we say it that way.
Yeah. We go brains.
Yeah. One of the great, great movie moments.
Yes.
It was really nice to have Michael on the podcast. I had first met him. He came and spoke to the Respectability Lab I was in. They had people come to speak, and he came and spoke. And it was just, I think, good to hear different people's perspectives. And I was really happy that we got to have him join us to talk about so many things. And I feel like we could have probably talked for so much longer, but you know, we only have a short time in this podcast. But it's just, yeah, it's always a pleasure to meet someone that you can talk to probably for a long time.
Yeah, it was the first time I chatted with him was when we interviewed him for the podcast, and I felt like he was already like a longtime friend. So I'm just sending out some well wishes to Michael, because he did have a surgery, as he mentioned in the podcast. So we hope he's recovering well and maybe getting to watch some films as he's recovering, because I know we know he enjoys that. So
yes, I hope he is. Sarah, is there anything that you've been up to this last little while?
Well, I have a little shout out to my therapist for being amazing and encouraging all people to have a therapist. I had an interesting incident at my child's Taekwondo class where a parent yelled at me, and it really was like, what? And it totally caught me off guard and wasn't, I was just like stunned. And so I had gone through all these like scenarios and plans on what to do if I see her again. And I could sense that I was going to spiral in this anxiety spiral, right? So luckily I had an appointment with my therapist the next day. It was very good timing.
That was very useful.
Yes. I came to the appointment. I said, hey, this happened. This is what I think I should do. And my initial idea was that I needed to go in and like sit down with her and say, hey, I see that you were really hurt, and I want to apologize for whatever you think I did to hurt you, blah, blah, blah. And then my therapist said, but did you do what she said? And I said, no. So do you need to say sorry? I said, no. She's like, do you know why you want to say sorry? I said, well, I don't want her to not like me, which is a core safety behavior. This is something I'm learning about in generalized anxiety disorder, the like therapy I'm doing right now. And so it is one of my safety behaviors, is to ensure that everybody around me is happy with who I am and accepts me and loves me and thinks I'm amazing. And so having this woman just not like me because she thought I said something that I didn't say, I was going to take on all this responsibility to like fix the situation. And it was just brilliant that my therapist was like, well, you did nothing wrong, therefore you should not be apologizing. And this is a good moment for you to practice not doing your typical safety behavior, which is doing what you can to ensure other people accept and love you. My therapist then went on to say, have you had any sort of interactions with this person prior to that incident? And I said, I'd never seen them in my life, so no. So why are you wanting to fix a relationship that doesn't exist? Just really good questions that they had for me that used a lot of curiosity in their approach of talking to me. And just like I was able to really pinpoint right away where my anxiety started and where I could make a shift and not fall down that same very ingrained groove in my brain. So it's going to be interesting going to Taekwondo next class and just going in like I always do and being the human I am and it, just accepting that somebody might not like me.
I read a really good post that I shared today about what masking is. And this person said that, you know, when you see my child, they're like a unique piece of origami. But when they're at home, they unfold all the folds so they can be just a piece of paper. And that over time, those folds become creases and they become scars. And that's what masking is. And I was like, oh my goodness, that is 100% correct.
Yeah, it was a really good analogy for what masking is for somebody. And like, it gave me even just reading that quote gave me a perspective as well. And I like teared up immediately and was like, oh my God, Heather. Oh.
I know I'm a people pleaser too, but also when you're in a situation where you sometimes don't feel like you understand everything, you just want everyone to like you. And because if they like you, that means you fit in. And I've sometimes felt very like outside of a lot of people growing up, or I felt like very different. And so in my difference, if I could be a chameleon and fit in, if I could fold my paper the right way, and then that meant people liked me, but not necessarily be myself.
It's interesting how there's all this overlap in, or again, maybe intersectionality between different brain stuff, like with my anxiety, you know, like I said, my core thing is like making sure I'm accepted and loved and da 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 da. Maybe there's some sort of attachment issues there, whatever. But you know, that's the same thing for you, but it presents in a different way because your ADHD is connected with it. Where for me, it's like my anxiety is connected with it, but it still probably stems from the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's layers and layers and layers and layers. It doesn't matter where you got the gift from. It's just a gift that you will carry for the rest of your life in some capacity, but that doesn't mean you have to. It doesn't mean that you have to hold on to it tight.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, therapy helps us learn, right? Like, okay, I don't need to go down that path for this specific situation, but also shows me like when I mentioned the story to my husband, he was like, well, that's weird. And then like, because he doesn't have this anxiety, it was actually kind of lovely because he said, are you okay? Like, how can I help you not think about this for the rest of the week? And then I said, well, I have a therapy appointment tomorrow. And he was like, great, that's really good. And then was like, I came out of my office at one point. He's like, did you have your appointment yet? And I was like, no, I'll let you know. And then I came back out another time and he's like, and I told him about my appointment. And like, I already felt like a huge lift, right? And so he gave me a high five. He's like, good job. So doing the work is hard. Like breaking these pathways that have been like ingrained in our brains for our whole lives is really hard. But something I'm proud of, so this could be my awesome thing, is that like my daughter was there with me, and like I feel like it was highly inappropriate for this woman to speak to me the way she did, but I did handle myself in a very like positive, I didn't get yell back at her, like I was a very calm person. And I walked away and my daughter was like, well, what was that about? And I was like, I'm not sure, actually. And I reflected and I came home and I talked to my husband and I got emotional. And then I was open about how I was going to talk to my therapist. And I feel like, and then I talked with my daughter afterwards about how like, oh, this is like how mom's going to deal with it. We're going to go into Taekwondo like any other day because I didn't do anything inappropriate or wrong. So it's going to be fine. Like, and I said, I might have to be a little more brave because my anxiety wants me to do something different. I'm going to be brave. Like I tell you to be brave when you're nervous about something. And then she was like, yeah, we can do it together, mommy. So I think being transparent with everybody in our lives is really important.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes you have those moments where you're going through a difficult time. I was really stressed and I woke up at 4:30 in the morning and I couldn't go back to sleep. So I got up and did some stuff. And then my husband asked me why and I explained. And then he did something for me to help me. Instead of me being like, I just couldn't sleep. I was like, actually, I was thinking about this. And I couldn't go back to sleep. So I just got up and did stuff. And because I had to get stuff done. And I think me not just being like, it's cool, I'm fine. But to say, hey, this is actually what's on my mind. It's just allows your partner or your friends or people in your life that you love in some capacity or that are just part of your life, they can surprise you with their care. Mm-hmm. That if you don't tell them and you keep that inside and it festers or you worry or this is my burden to carry as you kind of feel like that is that breaking of that cycle, because we've had to carry burdens in some capacity and now we're letting those go. Mm-hmm. I want to say there's some people who've been commenting on our podcast and leaving some reviews for us. Just thank you for those people who have done so. If you like our show, please also add a review or just message us and let us know what kind of things you'd like us to talk about, because we're doing this for us and you.
Yes.
Sorry, yeah. You first. I mean you first and then us.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Anyways, so thank you for listening to today's episode of Brains. Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor, which is us, and mixed and mastered by Tony Bao. Our theme song is by our little brother Depish, and our graphics were created by Perpetual Notion.
If you like what you hear, please, please rate and review us and tell all your friends to tune in. You can reach us on Instagram or Twitter at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website at brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little bit more about who we are and what we do. Until next time, I'm your host, Sarah.
And I'm your host, Heather.
Bye! Bye.
When you drive the brand ranked number one in dependability by J.D. Power, you can stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see yourself behind the wheel of the brand ranked number one in dependability by J.D. Power. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Kia received the fewest reported problems among all brands in the J.D. Power 2022 U.S. Vehicle Dependability Study based on 2019 models. See jdpower.com/awards for 2022 details.